Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
One of the most remarkable aspects of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. You're listening to the Mormon Channel of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Since its founding in 1830, many people obscure to the celebrated have said, written, and claimed much about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and subsequently its leaders and members. Many of those comments have surely been lost to the ages, but many were recorded and preserved and are still with us today. Joining me on Legacy today are Rick Walton and Kirk Shaw, editors of the book Much Ado About Mormons, What Famous People Have Said About the Mormons. Before we get into the books, I'd like to know more about the two of you. Rick, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, and then Kirk.
Well, I'm a professional writer. I write books mostly for children. I have a few dozen out, mostly picture books, joke books, poetry, activity books, mysteries. I live in Provo. I teach classes at BYU on picture book writing and the children's book publishing industry. I've got five kids from the 20s down to the 9s.
And so if you've done mostly children's books, what drew you to this type of compilation?
I have a lot of interests, and I do a lot of research on a lot of topics, and I kept running across these fascinating stories about what people said about the members of the church. I'd run into Dickens and Twain and some others, and I thought, if I'm enjoying these things this much, maybe somebody else is too. And so I started collecting them and doing research on them and digging deeper and contacted Kirk, and it became a book.
Excellent. Thank you. Rick was the compiler. Kirk, you're the editor. Tell us about yourself.
Well, I'm with Covenant Communications. I'm their senior editor. And I really have enjoyed working with books pretty much my whole career. I focused on books. And I've really enjoyed working with Rick. We've actually toyed around with a bunch of ideas. And he actually just came out with another book called CTR Cinderella, Cinderella story told through kind of an LDS perspective. That's kind of fun. And this book was especially fun to do with him because he came to me with the idea and pretty much the manuscript already kind of formed. And then we tossed back ideas on who to add and who was apocryphal, who didn't really have what it took to be in the book. And we came up with a fun compilation of modern and a lot of those fun 19th century people, too.
Very good. I'm sure you get this question all the time, but tell me why the playoff of Shakespeare's title, Much Ado About Nothing?
Well, I'd like to say there's something profoundly significant and symbolic about it, but it was just I like the title.
I see.
Because it kind of it's a memorable title. We have, as a church, as a people, we have created much ado. We're still creating much ado, and we've got all sorts of things going on. We've got people in dance competitions and performers and presidential candidates that people are talking about. We've got business people and all sorts of people who add to the much ado, and I just thought that would be a fun title and kind of be descriptive of what the book was about.
It's true. It doesn't seem you can turn on any reality show without finding a
token Mormon.
Exactly.
It's true. Interesting. So let's get into this book and find some of the more of your more favorite quotes from some of these people. I think the first one I marked was from John Greenleaf Whittier. And I was, I'll just read this section and then we'll talk about it. He evidently made a visit to Nauvoo and wrote, "Once in the world's history, we were to have a Yankee prophet, and we have had him in Joe Smith. For good or for evil, he has left his track on the great pathway of life, or, to use the words of Horn, knocked out for himself a window in the wall of the 19th century, whence his rude, bold, good-humored face will peer out upon the generations to come. But the prophet has not trusted his fame merely to the keeping of the spiritual. he has incorporated himself with the enduring stone of the great Nauvoo Temple, which, when completed, will be the most splendid and imposing architectural monument in the New World. Quite the words for such an early organization.
It's kind of the same thing you hear a lot of today, and a lot of the theme that you hear a lot in a lot of these entries. It's the idea that people think we're weird. They don't necessarily believe what we believe, but we think we're very interesting, and they're very impressed with what we do. Apparently, we've got something going for us that attracts people, even if they don't necessarily believe what we believe.
Well, and John Whittier was a Quaker, and a lot of those early Mormon converts were Quakers or a sect of the Quakers, like Sidney Rigdon, you know. And so I think maybe that's part of the draw there is here's a church that embodies what we kind of have looked to as a church that believes in prophets and apostles and all that was there with Christ.
And Whittier acknowledges that. He says, "In listening to these modern prophets, I discovered, as I think, the great secret of their success in making converts. They speak to a common feeling. They minister to a universal want. They contrast strongly the miraculous power of the gospel in the apostolic time with the present state of our nominal Christianity. They ask for the signs of divine power, the faith overcoming all things, which opened the prison doors of the apostles, gave them the power of the elements, which rebuked disease and death, etc." He's saying that the thing that attracts people to our church is the fact that we actually believe in the power of faith. We believe in miracles. We believe in things that the church at the time had kind of given up on. And that was attracting a lot of people, and it seemed to attract him too, to a degree.
It seems like the comments that these people recorded came after they actually had a visit with either Mormons or came to a place where the Mormons lived.
That's usually the case. There are a couple of sections in this book where that was not the case, and one of them we have might be a little premature. I'd like to discuss it anyway just right now, is Arthur Conan Doyle, because he is a really good example of the impact of actually meeting people you're going to be judging. When you actually meet people and get to know them, they seem to be much nicer and more normal than you might have thought before, because he is the only one we have twice in this book. The reason being, the first time was when he wrote A Study in Scarlet, which was the first Sherlock Holmes mystery. And in A Study in Scarlet, the villains are Mormon elders. And the book is full of all the stereotypes of the day, the evil Danites and the steal the girls away and take them as captives to Utah. And it was just really vile in a lot of ways. And then about 50 years later, he actually came to Utah, and 180 degree change. He just loved the Mormons. He loved the city. He loved everything. Once he finally met the Mormons, he realized that they're not at all like the superstitions, the stereotypes that he had based his book on. So,
it was a popular thing to write about the Mormons in the early days. That very
almost to the point of being funny. Some of the things are just so ridiculous. I read in doing research for this, I ran across an old magazine, the Rough Riders, I think it was. It's a book for youth about these people who are chasing down Porter Rockwell and Joseph Smith in Provo, and they were underground caverns and jumping out of temples and all sorts of things that people obviously didn't know anything about, but it was just so ridiculous. It's kind of like the movie Trapped by the Mormons, which at the time was pretty scandalous, but it's almost campy now. So, right. Just so ridiculously.
And we absurd. We do have one exception where Willa Cather is a great example of someone who's an author who seemed to see the Mormons for who they were, and kind of admired their pioneer spirit. If you don't mind, I'll just read a little portion of what she says. And this is in My Antonia, one of her best known book. All the years that have passed have not dimmed my memory of that first glorious autumn. The new country lay open before me. There was no fences in those days, and I could choose my own way over the grass uplands, trusting the pony to get me home again. Sometimes I followed the sunflower-bordered roads. Fuchs told me that the sunflowers were introduced into that country by the Mormons, that at the time of persecution when they left Missouri and struck out into the wilderness to find a place where they could worship God in their own way, the members of the first exploring party crossing the plains to Utah scattered sunflower seed as they went. The next summer, when the long trains of wagons came through with all the women and children, they had the sunflower trail to follow. I believe the botanists do not confirm Fuchs' story, but insist that the sunflower was native to those plains. Nevertheless, that legend has stuck in my mind, and sunflower-bordered roads always seem to me the roads to freedom. Isn't that just a neat sentiment about the Mormons, completely before its time?
There were not many recorded incidences during the Nauvoo period, but it was Charles Francis Adams and John Quincy who came to Nauvoo and had some opinions. Any favorites in that?
Well, it's interesting to read their description of Joseph Smith. Adams wrote that they were introduced to the celebrated Joseph Smith, a middle-aged man with a shrewd but rather ordinary expression of countenance, unshaved and in clothes neither very choice nor neat. Adams describes seeing the half-built Nauvoo temple. The architecture is original and curious. It's built by the contribution of one-tenth the labor and goods. The prophet seems to have drawn his ideas largely from the Jewish system. And he talks about his sympathies upon hearing of the way the Mormons were driven from Missouri, and he says, this is one of the most disgraceful chapters in the history of the United States and shows of the spirit of ignorance. Well, this was fairly common. Joseph Smith was not necessarily like the traditional presidential candidate of today, who with a rugged chin and the closely trimmed hair, and he was kind of rough in a lot of ways, and people saw him as that, but they saw through that frequently and saw his leadership abilities, his vision, his foresight. And one of the things that I thought was interesting about this is it kind of illustrates how God picks his prophets for who they are inside and not outside. And that's kind of what he was responding to. And a lot of these people who talk about Joseph Smith talk kind of give the same impression that he might not have been as impressive outside as some people, but his insight and his brilliance and his inspiration, his leadership were just inspiring. So
I'm not sure if I'm correct in this, but it seems like this is the same writing or the same visit where he wrote that it's not unheard of that, you know, when we look back, Joseph Smith will be one of the most influential men.
Exactly.
If that was the same.
Yep. I think this was the same visit.
I think the same visit, yeah.
Excellent. Yep. So Horace Greeley, known for the quote, whether he actually said it or not, "Go west, young man, and grow up with the country."
Yep.
had a few things to say about the Mormons as well. This is the one that I marked in his section. "Do I regard the great body of these Mormons as knaves and hypocrites? Assuredly not. I do not believe there was ever a religion whereof the great mass of the adherents were not honest and sincere. Hypocrites and knaves there are in all sects. It is quite possible that some of the magnates of the Mormon Church regard this so-called religion, with all others, as a contrivance for the enslavement and fleecing of the many and the aggrandizement of the few, but I cannot believe that a sect so considerable and so vigorous as the Mormon was ever founded in conscience imposture or built up on any other basis than that of earnest conviction." So he came and saw and wrote what he actually felt.
I love that observation because it's very generous in a way, and I think it's the way we should look at all groups. Whether we agree with them or not, is most people, most organizations are fundamentally good.
What's neat about Horace Greeley, too, is, I mean, he was kind of the Bob Woodward, the Seymour Hersh of that time. And so for a man of his stature, who's an investigative journalist, worked for the New York Tribune, for him to say something like that about the Mormons, you knew he had his facts straight. He was very unimpeachable in his research and in his reporting, and
he wasn't saying it because he wanted to impress us or anything. He was just saying what he observed.
He was exposing truth.
He didn't have an axe to grind in either direction.
No, he's a fun one.
So give me another one of your favorites.
Let's see. Oh, Buffalo Bill. So anyway, Buffalo Bill tells about how his wagon train was accosted by some strangers who were much more heavily armed than they were. And the leader of the strangers announced himself as Joe Smith, the leader of the Danites. And Joe Smith and the Danites apparently wreaked havoc on this wagon train, took away all their stuff and left them with very little. At the time, Buffalo Bill was interested more in a marketable story and appealing to probably the finances than he was to telling the truth. It was a fairly common thing in those days to have stories and go on the lecture circuit with these outrageous, outlandish, exciting experiences that you've had and draw large crowds and make your living that way. And I suspect he was trying to go for that. But it's a good example of how you don't take as gospel truth everything you read. he was elaborating quite a bit on what really happened, and it turned out to be kind of funny, but because obviously it was not Joe Smith. He was probably talking about Lot Smith, who was involved in this kind of thing, involved in accosting the Johnson's army troops and such. I'm sure it wasn't Joe Smith.
One of my all-time favorites was Cecil B. DeMille. And this is a man whom I've always admired, and just one of those real giants in 20th century art, kind of the Spielberg of his day. He directed silent films. He's probably best known for his role as the director of The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston. And he and President David O. McKay developed a really a neat friendship. So he was invited by David O. McKay to give the commencement address at BYU in 1957. And just some of the words from that I'm going to share are just really touching. They're just really fun to hear. Was such a man of such great stature and such fame, really, thought of the Mormon prophet and our church. He says, "I have known many members of your church, and I have never known one who is not a good citizen and a fine, wholesome person. But David O. McKay embodies, more than anyone that I have ever known, the virtues and the drawing power of your church. David O. McKay, almost thou persuadest me to be a Mormon. And knowing what family life means to Latter-day Saints, I cannot speak or think of President McKay without thinking, too, of that gracious and spirited young lady who is his wife." I'm just going to pause real quick and say, what a neat compliment to quote Agrippa, King Agrippa, from the Pauline epistles, and just to say, "David O. McKay, you make me want to be a Mormon." I mean, what a neat compliment there. And then he just says he makes a quick comparison, and very apropos for him to make this comparison. He says, "When Brigham Young saw the Mississippi River freeze over, letting the ox carts drive across, how could he fail to think of that earlier time when the Red Sea opened to let the children of Israel walk dryshod between the walls of water? Moses and Brigham Young were men of faith, a viral, driving faith, and that faith sustained their people through every hardship." So, just a fun piece of history where he shows his regard so openly.
And President McKay, I might add, reciprocated rather openly to Cecil B. DeMille when he introduced him. He said, "One element of greatness, we are told, is the ability to choose the right with invincible resolution. Your speaker for this evening has demonstrated in our country that he possesses this virtue, but it is not only in his ability to choose the right that I refer to him as a great man, but because of his soul, his faith in God, his confidence in his fellow men. I love him because of his nobility." So, as you say, there must have been quite a friendship between mm-hmm. these two men.
Yeah, it's exciting to see just what kind of effect an LDS prophet can have on the world and on the influential people of the world, and what a rapport that can develop.
This is the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. You're listening to Legacy, and we're visiting today with Rick Walton and Kirk Shaw, editors of the book Much Ado About Mormons, What Famous People Have Said About the Mormons. And we're reading some of the flattering and maybe not so flattering comments from some famous people over the past 180 years or so. Let's jump back in time a little bit to a famous American writer, Mark Twain. Everybody's heard of Mark Twain. And I think probably the one comment that maybe people equate with Mark Twain and Mormonism is his comment about the Book of Mormon, that
which
it's chloroform in print.
He did not read the Book of Mormon.
I find it a very interesting comment.
Yes, a professor of mine pointed out that proves he did not read the Book of Mormon because he did not get to the Book of Ether. Which would have been a better pun.
Good point.
And if he was being a comedian, when he got to that point, he would have used that term instead. But yeah, Mark Twain was really funny, and he was a satirist and made fun of a lot of people and a lot of things. And one of the reasons we have this in is, yeah, he's a little snarky about the church a little bit. He was snarky about a lot of things, but he's very funny in it. But one of the things that I found endearing was his account of meeting Brigham Young. He was visiting with his brother. His brother worked for the government, and Twain was a reporter. And Twain was trying to ask questions and find out things, and he was just kind of being a little bit annoying as a young, ambitious young man. And he says, but Brigham Young wasn't having anything of it. Twain says, by and by I subsided into an indignant silence, and so sat until the end, hot and flushed, and execrating him in my heart for an ignorant savage. But he was calm. His conversation with those gentlemen flowed on as sweetly and peacefully and musical as any summer brook. When the audience was ended and we were retiring from the presence, he put his hand on my head, beamed down on me in an admiring way, and said to my brother, ah, your child, I presume? Boy or girl? The thing I liked about that was that Twain is not about self-deprecation, making fun of himself in the process.
Because he actually recorded it and wrote it down for us.
He actually recorded and wrote it down, so I sense a little bit of admiration on the part of Twain for Brigham Young, in that even though he was a little bit indignant, as he says, but he talks about how calm Young was and how well he talked, and he lets Brigham Young have the last word there.
And so this was a portion from his book Roughing It when he went throughout the western mm-hmm. states. Is that true?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Another really fun one, kind of along the same lines, is P.T. Barnum, well known for his circus, well known for all the performances that he would do around the nation. He and some company were traveling around the states, and they stopped in Salt Lake and got to meet President Young and had an interesting interaction. He said, by invitation, I called with my friends on President Young at the Beehive. He received us very cordially, asked us many questions, and promptly answered ours. Barnum, said he, what will you give to exhibit me in New York and the eastern cities? Well, Mr. President, I replied, I'll give you half the receipts, which I will guarantee shall be $200,000 per year, for I consider you the best show in America. I mean, just that fun rapport. The fun banter that Brigham Young seems to show to many of his guests.
Now, one of my favorites is not quite as well-known as others. It comes from one of my favorite books from this time period. It's by Elizabeth Kane. She was Thomas Kane's wife, and she wrote a book called 12 Mormon Homes. And it's about a trip that she took. Brigham Young used to go south to St. George for the winter frequently. And he took Thomas and Elizabeth Kane with him once, and they stopped at 12 homes along the way. And she writes about each of those homes. And it's really interesting because she doesn't have an axe to grind. She's just telling what she sees. And you get you hear so much scandalous stuff about the early polygamists, about the early days of the church sometimes, or very idealized stuff. And hers is just straightforward, just what she observes. And she was surprised at some of the things she saw. She went to one home that I thought was particularly interesting, where she was not at all impressed with the women of the house. She seemed very rough and crude. And the woman was preparing dinner for them, and they were sitting down to dinner when some Indians showed up at the back door. And she talked to them a minute, and then she came back to dinner, and Elizabeth asked her daughter what she had said. She said, these guests came first, and I'm going to feed them first, but then I'll feed you. And Elizabeth was intrigued by that, and she said, is she really going to do that? And she said, yes, she will, and then she watched. And when they were done eating, she brought in the Indians. She fed them the same food that they had been eating them and treated them the exact same way. And she was very impressed. Elizabeth was very impressed that she said that her estimation of this woman went up 100% because she treated the Indians the same way that she treated Brigham Young and his party.
Were there any recurring themes within the Mormon culture from throughout these quotations from these famous people?
For me, the recurring theme with both sides is it's hard to judge somebody if you don't know them. We make a lot of our judgments based on stereotypes. We've talked about this a little bit already, but so often the positive views of the Mormons occur after actually getting to know the Mormons. And I think that's a good example for us, too, when we are tempted to judge others, other groups, other people. We should get to know them first, and once we get to know them, we realize they're a lot more like us than we think, than we used to think. They're real people with real needs and dreams, and their ideals are just as important as ours, and from where they're coming from, they are just as family-oriented sometimes and just as noble in their own way from their point of view as we are. And it's a lot easier to be more positive about people if we actually take the time to get to know them.
We were talking before we started recording of the comments from some of the presidents about the Mormons and how they're not quite as compelling. Why do you feel that way?
Well, because presidents are politicians, and when they come to Utah, I'm sure they're sincere, but they're trying to make a good impression on whoever they're speaking to. And that's part of their job, and you respect them for that. It's a good thing to try to look at positive. As a matter of fact, I think it's a good idea to look at everybody and expect everybody to be even better than they think they are. Look at them in positive and describe them as positive. I just heard a little talk by Viktor Frankl, who wrote
Man's Search for Meaning.
Man's Search for Meaning. And he was talking about how if you act like somebody is better than they are, they will become what they can be. If you act like they are what they are at the moment, they will become worse than they can be. But so if you look at people as the best that they can possibly be, then that will cause them to rise up in your estimation. So I think even if you're not totally sincere, I think it's still a good idea to be positive about people, even if it's for political reasons. But not all the presidents, not all these entries from presidents were in the same context. For example, James Polk. And this is another thing I saw a couple of times with President Lincoln, President Polk. President Polk said, I held a conversation with Mr. Amos Kendall and Mr. J.C. Little of Petersburg, North Hampshire, a Mormon today. They desired to see me in relation to a large body of Mormon immigrants who are now on their way from Nauvoo and other parts of the U.S. to California and to learn the policy of the government towards them. I told Mr. Little that by our Constitution, the Mormons would be treated as all other American citizens were without regard to the sect to which they belonged, to the religious creed which they professed, and that I had no prejudice towards them, that they could induce a different course of treatment. And then they arranged to for the famous Mormon Battalion. And he said, it is with the view to prevent this singular sect from becoming hostile to the U.S. that I held the conference with Mr. Little. And with the same view, I aim to see him again tomorrow. He did not necessarily agree with the Mormons either. He wasn't trying to flatter the Mormons, but he saw in the Mormons a chance for mutual cooperation, mutual benefit. The Mormons could help the country. He could help the Mormons. They had something in common, and they could work together even though they had differences.
Another neat trend I think we see with the presidents, but also with all these individuals, is I think there's a lot of things that we take for granted, good and bad. One thing that especially the presidents were noting as they were coming through Salt Lake is children and families and how Mormon families stood out to them. President Harding, for example, shares part of his recollections from his visit. I do not know but what Brigham Young was right in his religion. I have found a new slogan in your wonderful country, which I am delighted to adopt, namely, the one which refers to Utah's best crop. I do not know when I have seen so many happy, smiling, sturdy children in so short a period of travel. A thousand delights have come to us in getting more intimately acquainted with your wonderful country, but I love, above all else, the boyhood and girlhood of marvelous Utah. You also have Gerald Ford talking about that, too, where he just loves what Mormons are offering in the way of teaching their children good values and bringing them up in a home where they're loved and taken care of for the most part. A choir of primary kids actually sung on the White House lawn for President Ford. And so he got a special treat in seeing that. And I really do think that this book is kind of a mirror. We kind of set out, it was an interesting thing for people to read that was interesting. But as we worked on it more and more and talked about it more and more, it almost seems like it's a mirror for us to look at and say, here's how people who aren't used to our culture and our customs and what we do and how we go about it, here's a way for us to look at how they see us from the outside in. And it's a great way for us to look and see, like Rick said, how do we up the ante? How do we do better and keep doing what we're doing?
Excellent. As you say, it's interesting to know what people said about the Mormons. Who would have ever thought that Abraham Lincoln said anything about the Mormons ever? But he was made president, and he had troubles almost immediately with the Civil War. And so things were happening in Utah, but evidently it wasn't big enough for him to worry too much about. And this quote in here is quite amazing. He says, "When I was a boy on the farm in Illinois, there was a great deal of timber on the farm which we had to clear away. Occasionally, we would come to a log which had fallen down. It was too hard to split, too wet to burn, and too heavy to move, so we plowed around it. That's what I intend to do with the Mormons. You go back and tell Brigham Young that if he will let me alone, I will let him alone.
Very pragmatic.
Yep.
I love that.
And what's fun is there's actually a Library of Congress entry that shows that President Lincoln actually did check out the Book of Mormon. Whether he read much of it or not, we don't know. But for how we know what a reader and what a lover of books he was, I can only assume that he probably read at least part of it to find out what these Mormons were about. Another president, FDR, sent an interesting letter to the Churchills. The church actually gifted genealogies to a lot of the U.S. presidents that would go back quite a ways, give them nice editions of their family history. And in doing this, I'm sure a lot of interesting connections came up. And FDR actually noticed that in the Deseret News in Salt Lake, there was a direct link between Clementine, Churchill's wife, and the Mormons. And he says in his letter, "Hitherto, I had not observed any outstanding Mormon characteristics in either of you, but I shall be looking from now on. I have a very high opinion of the Mormons, for they are excellent citizens." So it's kind of fun that some of the biggest figures of the 20th century, through World War II and afterward and before, are joking around about being connected to the Mormons and what that entails.
The book is called Much Ado About Mormons, What Famous People Have Said About the Mormons, and we're discovering comments about Mormons from the likes of Mark Twain, John F. Kennedy, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. This is Legacy on the Mormon Channel of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So we've moved into the 20th century. What about more recent comments?
One of my favorite ones, and one of the most surprising things we found, was Sharon Osbourne. Ozzy Osbourne's wife.
How is it possible that any comment from an Osbourne could make it in a book?
That's what one would think. And that's why it was so surprising. I actually found this doing a search on Amazon.com, just a search for the term Mormon and look through autobiographies and things. When I ran across this, I went, "What?" And this is what she says. "One of the first things I bought for the house was a big old-fashioned telescope, which I kept in the living room area. And the first thing I did every night when I came home was to go to the spyglass and look out across the city to the Mormon temple on Santa Monica Boulevard. On top is a golden angel blowing a horn that glints at sunset. It was my ritual, a way of anchoring myself. And at night, with the city lit up, it was breathtaking. And I built a hot tub on the top terrace where you could sit and look out at it all glittering beneath you." And I thought, Sharon Osbourne gets anchored, grounded by looking at the angel Moroni. What kind of a world are we in?
Wow.
It makes you look at her a little bit differently than you would otherwise.
Another section you have in the book are the guests that the Mormon Tabernacle Choir has had over the years as they've come for the Christmas concerts. Mm-hmm. And a lot of comments have been quite positive about their visits.
Angela Lansbury has a really fun one. I actually got to see her perform in this concert, and so it was fun to kind of see what she thought of that performance and her experience with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. She says, "The spirit of this place, Utah, is so evident. It is all enveloping. It's all around me. I feel buoyed up by it. This has been one of the things I felt very strongly about being here. I didn't realize that I was going to be hit by this extraordinary spirit. I haven't experienced this before. It's quite unique, people doing something for the love of it, not for the almighty dollar, but just for the love of doing it, of joining together, expressing their sense of feelings about life and all the qualities that are inherent to the Mormon Church. This is something that is totally new to me. I had never been exposed to it, I didn't understand what it was about, but I am really fascinated by it."
Another guest was probably a year or two previous, was Walter Cronkite, longtime CBS newsman, and he had the opportunity of actually conducting the choir during this concert. And so he said, "I hope that somewhere Mom and Dad are proud that little Walter is performing with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. I have never been a religious person in the conventional sense, but I have felt nearer to my God the past couple of days than ever before." Seems that that's what these visits do for these people. It kind of disarms them, and they just basically fall in love with the people as they're here.
Exactly. That's kind of how Mike Wallace was when in his experience with President Hinckley and in coming to Utah, he has a fun little quote that we put in. When you come out here and talk to people, you look in their eyes, they're so happy. Everyone looks so innocent. Maybe there's something we've been missing.
I notice that all the time. I think it's a good idea to bring out these people to meet the Mormons however possible. We have a lot of writers and editors and things come out to Utah to visit, to do workshops and things. One of the things that always happens is they go away impressed with the people out here, and their views of the Mormons have changed. They don't necessarily join the church. They very seldom do. But they always go away our friends and with a new view of. I have one friend, a writer friend, who lived here for a while, and she's not LDS, but she knew the people quite well. When the Elizabeth Smart case was going on, when she was missing, one of the editors that she knew said, she ran away, didn't she? Nobody's that good. No family's that good. And this friend of mine said, oh, no, there are lots of girls that way, lots of good families, lots of good girls. That's very much the kind of people they are. And so we have a lot of people who get to know us and can become our defenders and our advocates. Even if they don't join the church, they become assets to our cause and our message.
As we've gone through most of these comments, it becomes apparent. We talked about the politicians and how you say perhaps they have something to gain by saying something nice. But these are memoirs and writing that doesn't necessarily try to sway anybody, you know, other than their actual just viewing what's going on.
That's what's so impressive about so many of them and why I think they're important. They don't have an axe to grind, as I mentioned. They're just saying what they believe. One of the ones we haven't talked about was Charles Dickens and his Uncommercial Traveler. When he came to do a report on the immigrants leaving England and going to the United States, and he came across this one ship that it just amazed him, because everybody, unlike what he was expecting, everybody was sitting around in quiet groups. They were well organized. They'd been there for a day. They were sitting around writing letters and reading, and families quietly working and playing together. And he wondered, who are these people? And his tour guide said, they're Mormons. Mormons? His expectations of what Mormons were like was very different, and he, to his credit, went on to say that he had come here with a totally different expectation of what Mormons were like, but when he came and saw what they were actually like, he had to admit that his expectations were totally wrong. His original expectations were totally wrong.
I also remember him expecting to find basically the riffraff joining the Mormon church, but if my memory serves, he says it's the fruit and flower of our country
exactly. That's
actually leaving. So,
and Elizabeth Cain says the same thing. She said she she attended a meeting with a bunch of Mormon women, and she was expecting to see what the common pop culture described. At the time, it was popular to describe the Mormon women as the lowest form of womanhood, the oppressed, the dowdy, the not very attractive, but she said, no, they're not at all like that. They were very confident. They were on the ball. They were just like any other group of women anywhere else in the country. They were very on top of things and smart and their own women and impressive people in their own right. So.
And speaking of Mormon women, Susan B. Anthony, when she came and spoke in the tabernacle, she was surprised partly by how the elders welcomed her up to speak, even though she was a woman, and that was relatively unheard of at the time. And she was amazed just by all the sisterhood, by how these Mormon sisters, Mormon women, would sing and worship together and had equal part with the men in celebrating and worshiping God. So that was kind of a neat piece that she shared.
Thank you. The book is called Much Ado About Mormons, What Famous People Have Said About the Mormons. We've had on Legacy Today Rick Walton, the compiler of these, and Kirk Shaw, the editor. And thank you, gentlemen, very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us, Nathan.
I'm Nathan Wright, and you're listening to the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We invite you to listen to new episodes of Legacy Saturdays at 1 o'clock. You can also download any Legacy episode at mormonchannel.org.